This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a look at the security of our voting systems and the launch of our next book club. But first, you know, we expect long-established healthy habits to be backed up by scientific evidence. And when your dentist scolds you for not flossing your teeth, we take for granted that his claim is backed by years of research. Well, it turns out that's not the case. The Associated Press reports this week that there's actually little evidence to support the idea that flossing is good for you. Here to tell us that story and other selected short subjects in science this week is Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science, joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, let's talk. What you mean it's not flossing? So on the word on the street is our dentists have been lying to us about flossing all these years?
Pretty much. So it's even in the dietary guidelines for Americans issued by the federal government that you're supposed to floss to help prevent plaque buildup and gum disease. And then when the Associated Press asked them for the scientific evidence behind it, he even filed a Freedom of Information Act request for information because he wasn't getting anything. And then 6 months later, in January of this year, they very quietly just removed the recommendation. And when he spoke to them, they said, you know, we looked and we realized we couldn't find any really credible, strong studies supporting the use of floss. And so they took it off the recommendation.
That doesn't mean it's not good for you. It's just that there are no studies that have been...
Right. They've done a lot of studies on flossing, but a lot of them are just very bad studies. They've got a small sample size. Maybe they're only looking at 25 people, or other ones looked at only a very short period of time, say 2 weeks. And then still other ones weren't actually looking at the stuff we want to know about preventing cavities and preventing gum disease. Instead, they looked at something like bacteria.
When you take that floss out, you see all this gook on it, don't you?
Right. It seems like it should be something that's true, but...
It's flossiness. How did it get started? Did somebody just make it up someday?
It kind of got started, back in the day when floss was first invented. That was, over 100 years ago. And then companies started patenting it. And companies that made floss were doing their own studies. But again, a lot of these were just... There wasn't a really strong basis of fact behind it. And so... When they were formulating these dietary guidelines, they just didn't have really good science. And even dentists' associations that say this is a recommendation from the American Dental Association, they cited studies that were very weak.
Okay, let's move on to what astronomers have found, or I guess it's better to say what they have not found out there in the middle of our galaxy.
So these astronomers were looking for a kind of young star called a Cepheid. These are about 10 to 300 million years old, as opposed to our own sun, which is a few billion years old. And they were looking for them in the center of the galaxy. And what they found is there's Cepheids in the middle of the galaxy out to a distance of about 150 light years. But from that point out to 8,000 light years, there's this ring where there's no Cepheids in it.
There's a hole in the bottom of our galaxy.
There's a hole, yep.
Wow. Do they have any idea why that is?
They think, the fact that Cepheids are so young, this suggests that their new stars aren't forming in that area and probably haven't been forming for, maybe 100 million years or so. And the question is, what is causing this? And so the researchers think that by further studying it, they might be able to tell how the Milky Way is evolving and maybe will continue to evolve.
All right, let's move on to this next story about something called, and this is fascinating, neural dust.
Yes, it's a great name.
Yeah.
So this has to do with existing research. Researchers are making these amazing breakthroughs with implanting electrodes into brains and using these electrodes to measure what the brain, what the nerve signals are doing. And so when they've done this, for example, in monkeys, the monkeys were able to control an external robotic arm just using their brains. But the problem with this type of implant is it's got these wires attached to it, and the wires have to run, through the skull outside the head. And that's just not feasible. That irritates the body. It's not good for a long-term implant. So what researchers at UC Berkeley are doing are creating this neural dust, which could be implanted into the body and then get wireless power from an ultrasonic source outside the body. So they wouldn't have any wires and they could stay in the body for, maybe up to 10 years.
How do they get it in? to your brain.
You would have surgery to implant it in the brain. And right now, of course, this is really early stages. Right. They haven't looked at it in the brain. They've looked at it in rats in the peripheral nervous system. So, you know, the nerves running to the arms and the legs. And also, another thing is that right now it's about 3 millimeters long. So this sounds pretty short, but what they're hoping to do is shrink down each implant till it's more like 50 microns.
So half the nanoparticle, width of human hair. Nanoparticle size or a little bigger?
Microparticle, I'd say. Yeah, they're thinking like 50 microns.
Now they can implant it in your brain. I'm opting out of that one. Finally, let's talk about rich people.
Rich people have more of everything,
including more insects in their homes?
It's true. Some researchers a while back did a survey of bugs in homes, and they looked at 50 homes in and around Raleigh, North Carolina, and they went over them with a fine-tooth comb, cataloging all the arthropods that lived in there. And what they found was in homes, wealthier homes, where there's an average income of about $176,000 a year, you have about 100 different arthropod families. But when they looked at less wealthy homes with an average income of $33,000 a year, they found only 74 arthropod families. So this means you've got more biodiversity in wealthier households.
And how did all the bugs get there?
It's because of landscaping. So if you picture a sort of, you know, wealthier neighborhood, you think of these rolling green lawns and having maybe a flower garden next to the door. And these are environments that foster a lot of biodiversity in bugs and in animals. And because the way bugs get inside is most of the bugs in the house are bugs that wandered in from outside.
Right.
So it makes sense that in houses where you've got a greater variety of bugs outside, you'll have a greater variety inside.
Here in the big cities like New York, we have lots of bugs, but they sort of crawl out in the middle of the night. You know, when you turn on the kitchen light.
I would much rather they stayed that way. I don't want to see them in the full light of day.
All right, Sophie, thank you very much. Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science, who is joining us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome back. Good to see you.
You too.
Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. The vaquita. You ever heard of it? It's one of the smallest and rarest cetacean species. The small porpoise is only found in the northern part of the Gulf of Mexico, right off the coast of Mexico, Gulf of California, right off the coast of Mexico. And scientists estimate there are just 60, I'm saying 60 vaquitas out there in the wild. That's total. Vaquitas have been swept up in the nets of poachers fishing for another endangered fish, the totoba. With such an extreme crisis, researchers are floating the idea of a risky conservation strategy, one that involves capturing and placing some of the vaquitas in enclosures out there in the Gulf. A similar strategy worked for the California condor, but will it work for the vaquita? Barbara Taylor has surveyed the vaquitas out in the wild as a conservation biologist at NOAA's Southwest Fisheries Science Center in La Jolla. And she's here to take us, lead us through the good and bad of this strategy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
You would keep the vaquitas in the Gulf where they are endangered, right? How would describe what that strategy would be like? How you capture them and keep them in one place?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty to the capturing and keeping them in one place. Vaquitas are very secretive, shy animals, and in 64 days of surveying last year, we only had 28 sightings. So they're hard to find, and they avoid boats, so capturing them by running a net around them would be extremely difficult. And then we don't know how the animals are going to react to being handled. Some porpoises do okay, and other species go into shock. So there's lots of uncertainties, and then there's the non-trivial issue of setting up a pen in a sometimes very violent part of the sea, and making sure that they aren't more at risk in one of these pens in a hurricane than they would have been out in the wild.
Well, this sounds like all the bad things about this. There's got to be a good side. Like if you don't capture them, they're going to become extinct.
So the reason that they are even closer to extinction than ever before, as you mentioned, is because of this illegal activity where they set these gill nets with no surface markings to catch this big fish. And it means that we have lost 80% of the species in only 4 years. So there's a tremendous amount of ongoing dangers, and despite heroic efforts by the government of Mexico to ban gill nets of legal fishing, the illegal fishing is still an enormous threat, and it isn't contained yet. And so the recovery team thought it's better to have some than none. And I was on a survey in 2006 to find the last of the Yangtze River dolphins and take them into Oxbow Lakes to protect them. And we were too late. We lost a species that's been here for 35 million years, and that had a profound effect on all of us, on the recovery team for what then became the most endangered marine mammal in the world. And we have had a lot of discussions on, whether or not taking some action to take some vaquitas into captivity would detract from the plan A, which is getting the gill nets out of the Gulf. And so we've been very concerned that it will be a bad thing by detracting from what has to happen, and that's getting gill nets out of the Gulf. And it's a real dangerous situation in that regard, but we all agree that if we don't take some steps now to learn whether or not it's feasible to save vaquitas, that door will be closed and we'll have fewer options for saving this species.
So you will be giving this a try?
They're taking the first step, seeing whether we can find them, seeing, you know, whether you can put a floating pen out there and have it be a safe environment. So it's a very thoughtful step-by-step plan, and if any one of those steps fails, then it's simply not feasible. And the other important thing to communicate is that this isn't like condors. We can't go out and simply round up the last 60 and take them into an environment where we know that we can be successful the way they could with condors. No matter what we do, it's going to take time, and most of the individuals are going to still be out there in their natural habitat where they should be, but where these dangerous nets are still not fully under control.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Barbara Taylor, a conservation biologist at NOAA's Southwest Fisheries Science Center in La Jolla, California. The Olympics start tonight, and after the break, we're going to have an expert break down what to look for in the swimming heats in terms of fluid dynamics and this new kind of kick swimming technique underwater that is turning the swimming world upside down. We'll talk about it right after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Tonight, the Summer Olympics kicks off with the opening ceremony in Rio. And the swimmers are the first ones up, and they take to the pool this weekend. There's some debate about what is the fastest swimming stroke. And it's not what you might think. It's not the crawl. It's definitely not the breaststroke. The speediest swimming style may be a version of the dolphin kick, known as the fish kick, a difficult stroke to master, performed entirely while the swimmer is submerged. And whether it's the fastest stroke, it's still up for debate between coaches and swimmers. But my next guest is here to tell us about the science of swimming. Rick Madge is a research engineer. He's also head coach of the Mighty Tritons Aquatic Club in Milton, Ontario, in Canada. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's talk about a bit about just the basics of physics of swimming. The idea is you push the water back and you go forward, action and reaction?
It's pretty much that simple.
Mm-hmm.
The big key there is that as you're trying to push through water, you have resistance or drag, and then as you push water behind you, you use that drag to your advantage.
Let's talk about this new dolphin kick, the one used swimmers dive in and they transition off the wall. We know about that. We've seen that. But there's this thing called the fish kick that's
different.
The fish
kick is usually what they call dolphin kick on the side. And it's just called that because that's more like what fish do as opposed to the up-and-down motion that we've been watching for the last 20 or 30 years in underwater swimming.
So the swimmer basically turns on the side and then makes a sort of a dolphin kick, but it actually uses more parts of the body from what the videos I see.
Well, some videos have large movements in the upper body, and that's not really worked out that well. The ones that make the most sense is where from about the sternum to the extended arms, the body stays very still. And then below that, it ripples somewhat in the fashion of, you can imagine, somebody kicking soccer balls forward and backward over and over again.
Now, I've seen a video, a YouTube, of Missy Hyman, a swimmer,
yes,
winning an event that was unbelievable. She never broke the surface of the water during a whole lap of a pool underwater using this fish kick.
Well, you're not allowed, according to the rules set up in the late 80s for backstroke and the late 90s for all the other strokes. You're not allowed to go more than 15 meters underwater. So, that's one aspect of it. But Misty Hyman is about the only one who has tried a totally undulating underwater kick with the whole body.
She's the only one.
I don't know of a lot of others who've done that and had really any success. If you look at the fastest swimmers in the world, none of them use that total body undulation on the fish kick.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that it might be tried more in this Olympics?
Not at this point, no. Strokes are pretty much locked in. There's another type of fish kick where they refer to as really the dolphin kick, but on the side. And that has some definite benefits to it and a few drawbacks as well. But it is something that you're going to see some of the swimmers push off on their side and kick on their side for a little while and then transition to the back or the stomach, depending on the stroke.
And that's only, though, you say, for the first, 15 meters?
15 at the most. The head has to emerge at that point other than breaststroke. But you're not allowed repeating dolphin kicks and breaststroke underwater, so that's pretty much limited by the nature of the stroke.
Why would that stroke be better than, let's say, the standard dolphin stroke?
Well, it gets down to why does underwater kick work? And the reality is that when you push off the wall or you dive in, you're going faster than you can possibly swim.
Let me hear it. Say that again. Aren't
when you
I
push
swimming?
Off the wall,
oh, I see. Then making the movements with your arms and legs. I see.
Yes.
So you're a little missile at that point coming up.
Very much. In fact, if you can push off the wall and maintain that speed, you'll do the length of the pool in as little as 15 or 16 seconds. Now, of course, you can't because water's fairly thick. So the whole purpose of the dolphin kick is to maintain your speed for as long as possible. So you're not trying to generate speed, you're just trying to maintain it. And to do that, we have to get into fluid dynamics. Specifically, you don't want to interrupt the laminar flow of water over your body.
You mean the smooth flow, the water is smoothly flowing over your body. You don't want to interrupt that and make turbulence.
Yes. So if you've seen car commercials on TV where they show the car in a wind tunnel, and they always have some colored streams that are being fed into the airflow, if you see that smooth color flowing over the car, then it is streamlined. Now, the thing about cars is they don't kick. So it complicates it tremendously when you take the body that pushes off and then you add undulations at the lower half. You have to keep those undulations more or less within the bounds of that laminar flow or else you create turbulence.
And so by doing that, the fish kick, you're basically undulating your body instead of disturbing the water with your feet kicking it. And that keeps the flow smoother.
It allows you to have some propulsion that offsets some of the resistance, but it doesn't disturb the laminar flow that's keeping you streamlined and relatively fast.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is, I know from submarine technology, we all know that a submarine can go faster on the surface than it can underwater. Why do you swim underwater faster than you could on the surface this way?
It's really surface tension. There's a lot of surface tension in the water. And if you have to continually break that surface tension, then you're going to be spending a lot of effort on that. But not only that, from the point of view of the kick, if you've seen little kids kick, a lot of times you can see their feet come out of the water and they slap down. They're spending a lot of energy kicking air. And as you can imagine, kicking air doesn't send you very far. You want to kick water to the point where you actually want to be at least half a meter underwater and preferably more, so that your dolphin kicks don't cause the water to swirl on the top, meaning that you're moving air. The deeper you can get, the more propulsion that you are getting out of the kick.
Do you envision if it's faster to use and it becomes more popular, we might change the rules to allow this to be used in competition?
Well, the dolphin kick or the fish kick, if you consider those as just variations in the body position, the body orientation, they put a limit on 15 meters, say, in the late 80s, simply because the 1988 Olympic 100 backstroke had people swimming underwater most of the time. And as a spectator sport, that's not very good. You had people popping up anywhere between 5 meters and roughly 40 meters down the pool. And they said it certainly is interesting, yeah. And it takes a lot of effort, and you have to match the oxygen debt versus the energy that you're putting in and all that kind of stuff. But just in terms of getting people to watch it, doesn't work.
Let me ask you one more question, because I was reading all the papers on this, and I came across some paperwork about how to hold your hands the right way. I mean, when I was swimming, I made a scoop out of my hands, but reading the paper says that's the wrong thing to do.
That's about the only wrong thing you can do with your hands is to scoop the water. Hands are interesting because you basically have a certain surface area of your hands if you hold your hand out flat. So if you were to press your hand down on a desk, you would have a certain surface area. And that surface area stays the same whether the hands are like fairly close together or if they're spread wide apart. And that's the dominant reason why you move forward and the dominant mechanism for moving water. If you squeeze your fingers together or if you scoop, you're actually reducing the surface area. And by doing that, you're making your hand less effective.
Now, do we want to keep our fingers together? I was reading in some of the papers where people were arguing with each other. How many fingers apart? Should we keep them together? What's the fluid dynamics of that?
Yeah, the fluid dynamics on this is probably a little more simple than a dolphin kick underwater. It has to do with the boundary layer, and that is that I call it the dust on the fan effect. If you can imagine, if you've got ceiling fans and you have to clean them, one of the questions that will come up is, why am I cleaning something that moves through the air all the time? How can dust stay on the fan? And the answer is that there's a very thin boundary layer that is attached to the fan surface where the molecules of air immediately above that, in that boundary layer, don't move.
Wow.
And that's a reason why dust can settle on the fan, and then the air moving across the fan because the fan's moving doesn't actually disturb that dust. Well, we can use that to our advantage when you're pulling. So if you use that boundary layer and you have, and it turns out to be roughly a third of an inch or 8 millimeters spacing between your fingers, no water is going through your fingers because of that boundary layer effect. So you've basically increased the size of your hand slightly with no detriment.
That's terrific. Now, I understand that's why when you wash your car, you can't hose off your car because there's a boundary layer of water that's not going to move the dirt either.
It could very well be, yes.
That's why you have to use a rag or something.
Take
the car. Fascinating, Rick. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. And how are the Mighty Tritons doing?
Oh, we're having fun, as always.
All right. You'll be watching this weekend, I'm sure. Rick Madge, research engineer, head coach of the Mighty Tritons Aquatic Club in Milton, Ontario. This week, the Department of Homeland Security said that it was considering classifying voting systems as part of the nation's critical infrastructure, a designation currently held by things like the electric grid and banking networks. That announcement comes in an unusual election season, to say the least, in which the Democratic National Committee has had its servers targeted by hackers, suspected by some to have connections to Russia. So if servers are vulnerable, what about electronic voting machines? How secure and reliable are our voting booths and our voting tallies? Bruce Schneier is a technology security expert, author of Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. He's chief technology officer at Resilient. That's an IBM company. He recently blogged about his concerns over our voting systems. He joins me via Skype. Welcome back to the program, Bruce.
Thanks again.
Avi Rubin is a professor of computer science and technical director of the JHU Information Security Institute. That's at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He's been following this for a while, and 10 years ago he wrote the book Brave New Ballot on Voting Systems. He joins me from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, it's great to be back. Thank you.
Are you both fearful about the security of our voting systems? Let me begin with you, Bruce.
I am. Everything we know about voting machines, electronic ones, computerized ones, is they're not very secure. They're not tested. They're not designed rigorously. And in many cases, there's no way to detect or recover from fraud. So there really is a disaster waiting to happen. We don't know when it will or if it will, but it's not pretty.
What's your biggest fear?
My biggest fear is that We wake up on Wednesday, and there is some evidence the vote was hacked. We don't know for sure. We don't know how. And it's in a state, in a precinct, that decides something important. And we don't know what to do now.
Avi, when we last spoke together, it was 10 years ago about this topic. Can't believe it's been so long. Has anything gotten better?
Well, yes. Unfortunately, I think the thing that's improved the most in the last 10 years is the sophistication of the hackers and the number of incidents that we see that are occurring daily. If you look at the news, you see that ransomware is becoming pretty common. That's where attackers lock up a system. So you could imagine, for example, if hackers were to launch a ransomware attack against a voter registration database, for example, right before the election, we may not be able to have a way to check who's eligible to vote. So I think that the voting systems in many states have improved. For example, in my home state of Maryland, we've gone from unauditable electronic systems to paper ballots. And a lot of other states have gone in that direction, but not all states. But I think that the big change that I've seen has been just how sophisticated the hackers are today, and they're sponsored by countries like Russia and China, which is a much more formidable adversary than we had in the past.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I want to go back to something that you said that was interesting. You're not worried about the actual voting booth itself, but about the voting rolls. Explain that a bit.
Sure. Well, voting is an entire process. And so I wouldn't say that I'm not worried about the voting machines, because in many cases I am. But the often neglected concern are the voter rolls, the registration databases, which include the lists of everyone who's eligible to vote. And if there were a hack, and there already is a documented case of a hack against a voter registration system, that could disenfranchise large numbers of voters, or it could even just bring into doubt whether the election was run fairly. And so we can't just concentrate on one aspect of the entire election process, but we need to look at the voter registration process and the way the databases are maintained and the security of that, just as much as we need to look at the place where the votes are actually cast and counted.
Bruce Schneier, your reaction?
I think Avi is certainly correct. Voting is a whole system, and we've already seen attacks against the DNCC and the Clinton campaign, which involves stealing data and publishing it. So that can certainly happen again. Attacks against voter registration systems, intimidations of voters. We've seen in the past websites go down the night before an election. We don't know if that's an accident or enemy action. You can imagine targeting the Get Out the Vote campaigns. These are all computerized now. There's a lot of things that can be done, and we don't know what's fair, what's not. If there's a major attack against one candidate to Get Out the Vote system, are they allowed to cry foul the next morning? I don't know. We don't know. There's no precedent. So yes, these are all risks, and there's a lot of unknowns.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to call in. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. So the election is just a few months away. Can we do anything now to help protect this vote? I'll ask Avi and then Bruce.
Yeah, so I think that there's plenty that can be done now. I mean, many of the precincts already have their equipment pretty much locked in. They've used them for the primaries, and they're not going to be able to change them. But we can increase the amount of auditing that we do and the amount of surveillance and care that we take. So, for example, most of the country is using paper ballots or paper verified audit trails, voter verified paper audit trails. And in places that do that, they can institute random spot checks. A professor from Berkeley has come up with a technique for reducing the risk of undetectable fraud by performing manual recounts in random spots against machines to make sure that statistically we know that the machines are counting the votes correctly. And also voter awareness, I think, is very important to increase about what to look for at the polls and what kind of audits are going to take place.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about this on number 844-724-8255. talking with Bruce Schneier and Avi Rubin. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Are you fearful? And maybe we'll have some hints about what to look for and what are some of the problems at the voting poll, at the voting booths and the poll places. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the security of our voting systems with my technology guru guests, Bruce Schneier and Avi Rubin. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's see if we can go to a phone call or two. Let's go to Rashad in Annandale, Virginia. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is, are any of these voting machines under any sort of regulatory authority at all? It sounds like there's no precedence for this in regards to hacking or you know, breaking into those machines. I'm actually a cybersecurity professional myself, and I work in the field of compliance. So, I guess the second question is if they're not at least held accountable by any sort of assessment or regulatory body, then is there a security operations centers? Are there security operations centers in place that actually monitor the traffic and activity of these machines?
Good questions. Bruce, do you want to take that first?
I'll start. I mean, there's some regulation on machines, but mostly states are left to their own devices. You know, we don't have one election here. We have 50-plus individual elections with different rules, different standards, different systems. There's not a lot of security standards, and those that are largely pre-computer and don't really look at the new threats and the new ways of attacking systems. This isn't all states. It tends to be all over the map. I actually like the idea of establishing election as critical infrastructure and having the federal government get involved, because I think you're right. We do need to see some national standards of security of these machines, and we don't have that.
Avi?
Yeah, I think that standards are definitely lacking, and if we do establish standards, we have to be careful that the standards are the right standards. Give you an idea of how bad it can be. Right now, the states of Kentucky and Pennsylvania have completely paperless electronic voting systems. But because of laws that were on the books long before these voting machines existed, there's an audit requirement in those states, and that's a standard that they have. And that audit requirement is not something that can possibly be met by the current systems that they have. And so I think we need to take some care and bring in the experts in the security community to establish the security standards. There is something to be said for the diverse set of voting equipment in different places, because it would take a different type of attack to attack each different type of voting system. But that said, it might be better to have a good standard everywhere than to have this hodgepodge of non-standard systems out there like we do today.
And we have different manufacturers using different methods in the voting.
Absolutely, yes.
The question that always seems to come up is, if we use a black box to get money from the bank at the ATM, why can't we have a secure voting system just like the banking people have?
Yeah, I hear that question all the time. And people need to understand two things. One is that banking is different from voting in that voting has an anonymity requirement. Imagine if your bank were to disassociate its customers from their transactions and wasn't allowed to keep track of who deposited money and who withdrew it. I don't think anybody would be very comfortable with that. And yet in voting systems, there's a requirement that there not be a linkage between a person and how they voted. And so by its very nature, banking is different. But another place that this comparison falls short, if you look at a bank, I'm personally familiar with JP Morgan, they have hundreds of full-time, professional, well-trained, many of them graduates of our security program at Johns Hopkins, security professionals. And those guys are working very hard to protect the systems. And there is nothing equivalent to that at any of the voting system manufacturers. I've actually yet to meet a voting system manufacturer that had even one full-time trained expert in computer security. And so if we're going to compare banking to voting, we have to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples and that a lot of effort is going in by skilled professionals to actually secure the systems.
You know what it sounds like? You know, they always talk about when we're in a new war, we're always still fighting the last war. It sounds like we're still fighting the last battles in the voting system instead of something new.
In a lot of ways, that's true. I mean, we tend to have laws and regulations that are well behind the technology, especially now the technology is moving fast. You think about voting, we don't do it every day. Every couple of years, we pull the machines out of their closets and set them up. We just don't have the same level of experience and training from the administrators, from the voting officials, or even from the users, from the voters.
Yeah.
It's not something we do very often. You're not going to get that same level of intimacy that you have with your computer systems. It's actually a very difficult problem to secure voting. That's why the experts fall back on things like paper that can be reviewed if there's a problem, because it's one of the tools we know that works.
And any change is going to cost the M word, money, that states may not want to or have the money to change.
And this is a problem after the 2000 election. We had the Help America Vote Act, which enabled states to buy new machines. Unfortunately, the machines that they were buying were these computer machines, which look good but end up having these insecurities.
You know, pretty much every election season, there are proposals for internet voting, now maybe cell phone voting. From what I hear you saying, that this could be even worse if we allow that to happen. It's open to hackers more, Avi.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we would take a bad situation and make it a lot worse if we allowed internet voting. Right now, the internet is really under siege. And what happened to the DNC, where their emails got hacked, that's happening pretty much to any organization that's online that represents a target. And software is known to have vulnerabilities. And when a dedicated state-sponsored attacker decides to go after you, they succeed. And so I think that we should just look at the news and see all the stories of all these major corporations. I could rattle off a bunch of names, but we've all seen this, getting hacked and compromised, and say to ourselves, is that really what we want from our voting systems? And furthermore, if we do allow for this type of internet voting, right now we have a major party candidate who's already declared that the election is going to be rigged against him. And what we need now are systems that allow us to rebut that and to have confidence that the election worked properly, that the mechanics of the election worked fine. And going to the internet is going to do exactly the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask both of you, what would be, I'll give you my blank check question, if you could spend all the money and you could create a brand new system, what would be the ideal system? Avi, let me start with you and then get Bruce in the few minutes we have left.
Sure. I think that a system that could be very good already exists. It's already out there. And it actually, I think, is less expensive than many of the systems that were sold. It's simply a machine that's a ballot marking machine. You have a view of all the candidates and a touch screen, and you can have capabilities for sight impaired voters to have audio. And at the end of the process, the machine prints out a paper ballot. That machine is completely disjoint from any other system, and you could even request to fill out the ballot by hand if you like. And that paper ballot is then the ballot of record, gets fed into an optical scanner, and then you have a certain number of random spot checks of the optical scanners to make sure they're counting correctly. What I like about the system is if there is a controversy, if there's someone claiming the election wasn't run fairly, you can go back and recount the ballots. And the voters got to see the ballot and got to make sure that all of their selections were made and that at the end of the day, those selections are still on that paper ballot, mm-hmm. which is going to be the ballot of record.
Bruce?
So that is really the best system. We use something similar in Minnesota. It's all hand filled in. We have an optical scan reader. I get a paper ballot. I fill in ovals. I can check it. I know it's correct. Feed it into a machine. The machine checks to make sure I didn't vote incorrectly. I didn't actually vote for two people for the same office. And then that count is done by a computer, and that paper drops into a box that's safe for recount. And that voter verifiable paper trail is what gives us our security and integrity. Now, that has problems, right? I have to go and vote. To vote absentee, I get that paper ballot in the mail, I fill out the ovals, put it in an envelope, that gets sent to the election office, and then that gets counted with the other ballots. It's a really nice system. Technology exists today, and it's a lot more secure than these old computer systems.
And, of course, you could always take a photo with your cell phone of the ballot itself as a backup to know what you actually voted.
Well, Ira, before you go there, it's tricky. In any one of these systems, even one small suggestion can lead to problems. One of the issues that's of concern is vote selling or coercion of voters. And so if you're going to take a picture of your ballot and show it to someone, you can get paid for how you voted, or you could keep your job if you're being threatened.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's just something to watch out for.
Although any system that allows for voting by mail is subject to that.
Okay.
They give you a ballot. This you can always give it to somebody else.
Still sounds scary. As you say, it hasn't gotten better in 10 years. Bruce Schneier is technology security expert, chief technology officer at the Resilient at IBM. Avi Rubin, professor of computer science at Johns Hopkins, author of the book Brave New Ballot. 10 years ago. Time for a new edition, Avi?
Well, if something will change, I'll write another book.
Fair enough. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Time to page all bookworms. Time to reconvene the Sci-Fry Book Club. This winter, we read Oliver Sacks' On the Move, the late neurologist's autobiography. And now we're going to turn to fiction, science fiction, and dive into a world with wildly bioengineered animals, a completely new kind of human, and look at how the world as we know it could or maybe end. All that and more in Margaret Atwood's novel Oryx and Crake. It's been out quite a while. And it all sounds kind of bleak, but it is fascinating. And please join in and tell us what you think. We're going to kick off our book club, and our sci-fi savant Christy Taylor is here to explain how. Welcome, Christy.
Hey there, Ira.
Tell us about this month's book pick.
Sure. Well, personally, it's one of my favorite works of Margot Atwood would call it speculative fiction herself. But Oryx and Crake, the title characters, are actually not really around for most of the book. Our main character is this guy named Jimmy, who we meet at the end of the world. He's pretty much alone except for these specially engineered humans that you mentioned. And he's reflecting on the not-too-distant past, which is one of climate change, wild gene splicing, pigs growing human organs, raccoons crossed with skunks, sort of a crazy, wonderful biotech world. And it's kind of a funny book, despite being pretty bleak. Margaret Atwood was pretty adamant about this herself when you talked to her in 2004 about it. She made a pretty big point about that.
So is the bleak future in Oryx and Crake, is that a warning or is that a prediction?
Well, let us just say that this is a fun-filled, joke-packed adventure novel about the possible downfall of the human race. So we can say bleak times, but lots of times have been bleak. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we can do as human beings is we make jokes and we laugh. And while you're laughing, you're still alive. Let's just put it that way.
Margaret Atwood back in 2004 on Science Friday, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now I already had read this book with Margaret back then. Why pick this to read again?
Well, it's a really great book, first of all. But also, if Margaret's description didn't do it for you, there's a lot of science that's actually changed in the last 12 years. We've had the CRISPR revolution. Just the other day, the NIH announced that they are looking at proposing rules under which we can get federal funding for research that involves crossing humans and animals.
Just like Margaret said
book. Yeah, and she even said in that interview that we didn't air, she said she did everything that she put in that book was something someone was working on somewhere. She had two big boxes of research. She does not just make things up, which is why she calls it speculative fiction. So there's a lot to look at from our modern perspective that I think we can enjoy or find.
So we'll all meet back here in 3 weeks. We'll be reading the book.
August 26th with two very special guest readers, Terry Johnson, a bioengineering professor at UC Berkeley and author of a book about some of these same subjects. And then Annalie Newitz, founder of IO9, tech cultural editor at Ars Technica, and author herself of a book about surviving mass extinction.
Mm-hmm. And our listeners can read along with us. And how can they get involved in all this?
Well, it all starts at sciencefriday.com, our website. And for getting your own book, this is a very special giveaway we have with Powell's Books. We have 40 free copies to give away today. So if you just go to our website, sciencefriday.com, you will see a banner that is open until 10 p.m. Eastern time today, and we will sort out a random selection of 40 people who will get a copy of the book sent to them. Thanks again to Powell's Books. They've been doing this with us for about 5 book clubs now, so we really appreciate that. And if you don't get into the drawing, we have 30% off copies also through Powell's Books, also on sciencefriday.com. They should be tweeting at us at the hashtag Sci-Fry Book Club. We have that old interview with Margaret Atwood up on our website as well. Adult coloring book pages, thanks to a very great artist that's been working with us. We have a plethora of things to do.
It's a lot more than we had when we read it in 2004.
The future is a beautiful place, Ira.
And it's interesting because she does, as you say, she does say that she's not a science fiction writer.
Right. She really is clear that it's speculative fiction. This is stuff that she thinks, if not, it's a definite future. It's something that could happen just based on what people are doing today.
And it's a really quick read, isn't it? You go right through this book very quickly.
I am not always a fast reader, and I still got through this book in about a week on the train, mostly.
And if you like dystopian novels, this one is for you.
Yes, I would call this my top comfort read of all
time.
This
is a comfort read?
If you like dystopian novels.
Well, okay, so we'll be back here in what week are we in?
3 weeks from now, August 26th. Read the book. Call in when we do the show. Tweet at us, hashtag Sci-Fry Book Club, and get your free copy of the book from Powell's Books by going to our website.
It's our hashtag Sci-Fry Book Club, and go to our website. And you get that free book from Powell's Book. You can win that, but you get 30% off buying a book anyhow.
Yes.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thank you, Christy.
Thank you.
Christy Taylor, associate producer here at Science Friday. One more announcement before we go, and this is a great one, too. We've been on the air, you heard this interview, we've been on 25 years, and I can't believe that either. We're going to have a big gala celebration on board the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum in New York. That's the big aircraft carrier out here on the Hudson River. We're going to have a great gala that night, October 15th. You want to come to our gala on October 15th? It's going to be terrific, all kinds of fun and excitement. Go to our website, sciencefriday.com/gala. sciencefriday.com/gala, and come to our gala. Make plans to be in New York October 15th. It's going to be fun. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Get ready for our gala coming up October 15th. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.